This is Charles Thomas Casey. I am a grandson of Edgar Casey and the president of the Association for Research and Enlightenment, the organization that studies the work of Edgar Casey and his ideas from his psychic readings. You are about to hear the story of perhaps the most documented psychic of all times. For most of his adult life, Edgar Casey would, usually twice a day, lie on a couch, go into an unconscious trance state, and respond to questions asked him. The answers to the questions proved to be very accurate, especially related to specific diagnoses of physical illnesses and suggested treatments, but also on many other subjects. ESP was demonstrated over and over again in these psychic readings. It is a story of a young man's struggle with what he felt was a God-given talent. But it was a talent fraught with problems and confusion. It is also a story of how a man and woman's love formed the foundation upon which a lifetime of unusual service was built. And it is a story that for many people provides missing pieces to the puzzle of life's perennial questions. Who are we really? Why are we here? What happens to us when we die? Why is there so much pain and seeming injustice in the world of a loving God? For many who read or hear the story of this boy from Kentucky, his strong spiritual faith, and his unusual psychic ability, the burning question is, what does this story mean? What are the implications? Edgar Casey's life is a kind of confirmation that there is truly more to us than meets the eye, more than a physical reality. I hope you complete the story with a renewed sense of hope regarding the potentials of mankind and perhaps ideas and questions for further exploration. Before we begin listening to There Is a River, you will hear the only recording of Edgar Casey's own voice giving a psychic reading. This wire recording has been kept in the Edgar Casey Foundation archives. We thought it would be appropriate to present his voice for the first time, along with his life story, on this audio tape.
Any stimuli to express good, but an stimuli that makes for the circulation in any portion of the body may clarify, as it were, the cobwebs or cloud forms, the circulatory activity to the brain, which is reached by the circulation through the secondary cardiac forces, as indicated disturbances are. And moderation. Moderation would mean for this body anywhere from 3 to 6 to 8 smokes a day. Above this will be expected. A liquor or wine are both harmful for this body.
Are beneficial.
If taken in moderation. Again, while there has been a decrease in the ability of the body to carry on those of fermentation, there is the necessity for stimuli that does not become excessive or that the body does not rely upon for its quantity of producing the necessary stimuli for the assimilation through fermentation and assimilating activity. For only that as forms into death or into those processes as in those of certain forms of power, those as in certain forms of the activity that make for the ability of simulation through portions of the body, as in those activities, then characters of
the farm was a beautiful place to live. Edgar loved the rolling fields and the patches of forest. He liked the big houses and the clusters of barns that dotted the landscape as far as his eyes could see. In summer, Fishing was his greatest joy. Then the days were long and hot, and the men worked in the fields. The women stayed indoors, canning fruit and vegetables. And he had no playmates but his sisters. He spent long hours by the water, dreaming as he waited for a fish to come and take the worm he offered. His little playfolk came to him there, to be with him. They were always his size. As he grew older, they grew older. Sometimes there were only a few of them, sometimes many. They went away when another person came, unless it was little Anna Say. He wondered if the playfolk would come after Anna and her father had both died of pneumonia. When spring came, and he went to the woods, they were there. But as he played with them, he realized that they had stopped growing. He knew then that he was going to lose them. He dreaded the day when they would not come to meet him. But when it arrived, he found he didn't mind. He listened more intently to the birds than the other sounds of the woods until the living things around him took the place of his friends. Next to his mother, his grandmother was his best friend. His father was nice, but he didn't have time for a small boy. He was always smoking a cigar and talking to the men about politics. He was justice of the peace now, and everyone called him Squire. Grandmother had lots of time to talk, and she liked him to tell her about seeing Grandpa. He saw Grandpa sometimes in the barns. He never told anyone but Grandmother. It was a secret between them. He and his mother talked about everything and anything, and that was why he liked her best of all. She never laughed at him or teased him, so he was never afraid to tell her what he thought. He was 7 before he went to school. His teacher was gentle with the children, and they loved her. Edgar learned things quickly in her class, because he wanted to please her. But she went away when spring came, and in the fall, they sent him to the subscription school. He didn't like it there. Every time the teacher called on him, he was thinking about something else, and he never knew the answer to the question. When his teacher left to get married, he had to do better because his father took over the teaching job. His father was a stern man with a quick temper. He struck first and asked questions afterward. But still, Edgar dreamed, and he didn't know the lessons until his knuckles were raw from being rapped. It was different at church. He was 10 the first time he went to the Christian church at Old Liberty. He liked the story the preacher read from a book, and he wanted to know all about it. When they got home, his mother gave him her Bible, and he read it all afternoon until she took it from him. His father brought him a Bible from town. He wrote the date on the flyleaf, January 14th, 1887, and began reading. By the end of June, he had gone through the entire book. One day, he conceived a great ambition. He wanted to read the Bible through many times. He had heard one of the men at church say, "Well, I read the Bible through every year." And that gave him an idea. He decided to read the Bible once for every year of his life. He would read as fast as he could until he came even with his years. And after that, he would read it once a year. As soon as the idea entered his head, he turned to Genesis and began the task. From then on, he never went any place without his Bible, though he generally managed to conceal it so people didn't know he had it with him. He read it at every possible moment, giving only the time that was absolutely necessary to his chores and paying almost no attention to his schoolwork, since his father was no longer the teacher. When spring came, he went to the woods and built a retreat for himself. It was a lean-to fashioned of saplings, fir branches, moss, bark, and reeds from the edge of the brook. And it stood by the willows where the stream took a bend. The water looked so inviting that he dug himself a well to act as a filter. There he sprawled in the sun through the long spring and summer afternoons, reading. When winter came, he had to go indoors. He huddled by the kitchen stove, undisturbed by his mother, who looked over his shoulder now and then to see what chapter he was reading and to whisper something about it that helped him to understand the words. Again and again he went through the books and chapters until the pages were as familiar to him as the pictures on the walls of his house. Each time he waited from day to day with rising excitement for the great climax, the last chapter of Malachi, the end of the Old Testament, when the coming of the Lord was prophesied. Just 4 more verses after that, and he could turn the page and find the New Testament of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. When it was all over, and the fiery book of Revelation was finished, he would rush back to the beginning. So quickly did he read that by his own account, he had been from Adam to John a dozen times by the spring of his 13th year. As soon as the weather was good, he went back to his retreat in the woods. There one afternoon in May, as he sat at the entrance of the lean-to reading the story of Menorah, he became aware of the presence of someone else. He looked up. A woman was standing before him. At first, he thought it was his mother. The sun was bright, and he couldn't see clearly after staring at the book. But when she spoke, he realized it was someone he didn't know. "Your prayers have been heard, Edgar. Tell me what you'd like most of all, so that I may give it to you." Then he saw there was something on her back that was shaped like wings. He was frightened. She smiled at him, waiting. He opened his mouth and heard himself saying, "Most of all, I would like to be helpful to others, especially to the children. The children when they're sick." Suddenly she was no longer there. He took his Bible and ran home to tell his mother about it. He found her in the kitchen alone. She sat down and listened to him. When he was finished, he felt ashamed. "Do you think I've been reading the Bible too much? It makes some people go crazy, doesn't it?" She looked at him and smiled. "You're a good boy. You want to help others. Why shouldn't your prayers be heard?" "But we better not tell anyone about this." "But what does it mean?" "It might mean that you're going to be a doctor someday, or it might mean that you're going to be a preacher or a missionary." "That's what I'd like. I'd like to be a missionary." "Well, let's get a start by cleaning the milk pails. Cleanliness is next to godliness." That night he slept very little. The next day he was dull and listless in school. The teacher, his Uncle Lucian, asked him to spell cabin, but he couldn't do it. His uncle was irritated. "Stay after school and write it 500 times on the blackboard." It took a long time to write the word so many times. He was late getting home, and the squire was furious. After supper, he took the spelling book and made Edgar go with him into the parlor. "You're going to start learning your lesson. Sit down now and get to business." It was a long evening. Time after time, the squire would take the book and ask the lesson. The answers would be wrong. He would hand the book back grimly. "I'll ask you again in half an hour." At 10 o'clock, the answers were still wrong. The squire slapped him out of his chair and then picked him up from the floor and set him in the chair again. "One more chance." At 10:30, the answers were still wrong. Again, Edgar was knocked out of his chair onto the floor. Slowly, he got to his feet. His ears were ringing from the blow that had floored him. But he thought he heard a voice inside him. It was the woman he had seen in the woods. She was saying, "If you can sleep a little, I can help you." He begged his father for a rest. The squire agreed to leave him for a few minutes. "I'm going to the kitchen. When I come back, I'm going to ask you one more time. It's your last chance. You'd better know that lesson." He went out of the room, and Edgar closed the spelling book, put it back of his head, curled up in his chair, and almost immediately went to sleep. When the squire returned from the kitchen, he snatched the book, waking him up. "Ask me the lesson. I know it. I know it now." The squire began. The answers came quickly. They were all correct. "Ask me the next day's lesson. I'll bet I know that too." The squire asked the next lesson. All the answers were correct. "Ask me anything in the book." His father skipped through the pages at random, asking the hardest words he saw. Edgar was right. Each time. He began to tell where the words were on each page and what the illustrations were. The squire closed the book and slammed it on the table. "What kind of nonsense is this? You knew the lessons all the time. You knew the whole book. Are you just too lazy to stay awake at school?"
"I didn't know it until I slept on it. Honest."
The squire knocked him out of the chair again. "Go to bed before I lose my temper." The next day, he knew all the spelling words at school, but was as poor as ever at the other lessons. He took the books home with him and put them under his pillow before going to sleep. The next day, when Uncle Lucian asked him a question in geography, the picture of a page in the textbook leaped into his mind, and he read the answer from it. It was the same with all the other subjects. Each day, he took his books home, and at night, he slept on them. He began to make progress as a scholar. Uncle Lucian advanced him a grade and spoke to the squire about it. He seems to know everything in the book, Leslie. No matter what I ask him, he has a right answer. It's almost as if you were reading it. The squire took his son aside. What's going on? How do you do it?
I just sleep in my books, that's all. When I wake up, I know everything in them.
The squire looked at him worriedly. I sure hope you're not crazy. When Edgar was 15 years old, the new teacher at school, Mr. Tom, called him to his desk. I've been talking to your father. I remarked to him that you were my best student, and you always knew your lessons. He told me you go to sleep to learn them. How do you do it?
Well, I don't know, really. I just put my head in the book, and when I wake up, I know the lesson. I don't know how it works.
He was embarrassed, but Mr. Tom tried to reassure him. There's nothing odd about it. There are many things in life we don't understand. How do you see your lessons? In pictures?
Yes, I see pictures in the pages.
Well, I won't bother you about it. Don't let it worry you. And don't stop doing it. There's no harm in it. Edgar ran out to play with the other boys. They were playing a variation of prisoner's base. And when he ran for the base, the ball hit him on the spine. After classes started again, the teacher realized that Edgar was acting strangely, laughing and giggling and causing trouble in class, which was not like him. Thinking that their talk had upset Edgar, Mr. Tom said nothing. But on the way home, his odd behavior continued. He rolled on the ground and jumped into ditches and stood in the middle of the road, trying to stop traffic. During supper, he threw things at his sisters and laughed uproariously. His father made him go to bed. When he was under the covers, he gave instructions for a poultice to be put on the back of his head near the base of the brain. He was suffering from shock, he said, and the poultice would cure him. The ingredients for the poultice were cornmeal, onions, and herbs. Not knowing what else to do, his parents prepared it and applied it to the spot he had specified. When he opened his eyes the next morning, he found neighbors and relatives sitting around his bed.
What's the matter? Did I get run over?
He remembered nothing from the time he had left Mr. Tom at recess. The squire told him what had happened. You told us you'd had a shock and put a poultice on the back of your neck. How do you feel now?
I'm fine.
The squire beamed at his relatives and friends. Cured himself. Ever see the beat of it? I tell you, he's the greatest fellow in the world when he's asleep. That was his last year in school. He turned 16, and Uncle Lee gave him a job doing farm work on Grandmother's place. He worked all day with the men in the fields and ate most of his meals at the big house. He talked to Grandmother a lot. She was bedridden now, and he would sit by her bedside and tell her about his day. Often she would talk to him about his grandfather. Your grandfather was a very remarkable man. Anything he touched, he could grow. All the wells in this neighborhood were dug when he told the men where to dig them. And he knew how to find water with a hazel twig.
I tried that. I tried it out in the woods, and when I dug down a ways, I found water.
You're a great deal like your grandfather. It may be that you have some of the same powers. He could see things, the way you can see him in the barn sometimes.
He had the second sight.
He could do things, too. He could make tables and chairs move and brooms dance without touching them. But he never made a show of it. He said that that would be wrong. He said God gave him the gifts of making things grow and of finding water. He wanted to use the gifts that would help other people. So you shouldn't be afraid of the power you have. Just don't misuse it. It was given to you so you could help people. Don't ever forget that.
Grandmother died in August, and they buried her next to Grandpa in the cemetery with all the other Caseys. With his mother gone, the squire's interest in farming faded. He decided to move to town to sell insurance. Edgar chose to stay on the farm. He liked farm work, especially when spring came and he could get out of the barns and into the fields. He was alone most of the day, plowing and planting. He had lots of time to think about being a preacher. He knew he had to get more schooling somehow. He had to save money. The squire couldn't afford to send him to school, not with four daughters to support. But if he could save enough to start school, he might be able to borrow money from somebody. And he could work while he was in school. In the meantime, he would keep reading the Bible and teaching Sunday school. One late summer day, Edgar was standing behind the counter of the Hopkinsville bookstore when Ethel Duke, a former schoolmate of his, drove up in a carriage, and when he went out to speak to her, she introduced him to her cousin, Gertrude, who was sitting beside her, and invited him to a party that Friday night. When Friday came, he left home right after supper. The moon was rising as he approached the party. He saw the lights of Japanese lanterns and the sounds of laughter and talk. The house, which belonged to Gertrude's family, seemed to him like an enchanted castle, though he told himself that it was much smaller than his grandmother's house. He walked around the backyard. It was a lawn that stretched all the way to the orchard. Tables had been set out. On them were cut glass bowls filled with lemonade and platters of cookies and cakes and sandwiches and fruit. There were benches and chairs. But most of the people were sitting on the ground using handkerchiefs or jackets or shawls to protect their clothes from the grass stain. Ethel spied him and took his arm. She introduced him around and got him something to eat. Then she led him to Gertrude, and she disappeared. Gertrude was dressed in a long white gown and wore a red rose in her hair. She was even more beautiful than she looked when he first met her. She wanted to know all about him. "What are you going to be?" "I'll bet you'll be the owner of a big bookstore someday. That would be grand." He started to tell her that he wanted to be a preacher, but he stopped. Instead, he told her how he got the job in the bookstore. "I knew from the beginning I wanted to work in a bookstore. Mr. Will and Mr. Harry said they didn't need anyone in the store, but I asked them to let me try anyway. So now they can't get rid of me because they're so used to having me around." She laughed. She was easy to talk to. He told her all about the new books at the store. They talked on like that until people began leaving the party and Gertrude had to say goodbye to them. "I'll say goodbye to you now, but I hope you'll come back again." She smiled at him. After he had thanked the members of her family, he slipped away and hurried down the carriage drive. He walked alone in the dark, thinking of Gertrude. When a carriage came, some of the guests from the party overtook him. He was glad to accept the offer of a ride. Sitting backward with his feet swinging out in the night, he made a decision. He was going to marry Gertrude. Well, the seasons passed. Edgar was in love, and he was happy. That he loved Gertrude was not the chief source of his happiness. It was her love for him that constantly thrilled him. That she did not tire of him. That she liked being with him. That she chose his company above anyone else's. Was at times almost more than he could bear. Her family took Edgar in as one of them. And this, too, filled him with wonder. In March 1897... with their blessing, Edgar and Gertrude became engaged. Now they went everywhere together. By this time, Edgar had lost his shyness and fear of people. He knew most of the people his age who lived in the town. Some of them went to his Sunday school class. Because of his knowledge of the Bible, Edgar was accorded an intellectual status above that of his students, although many of them had gone far beyond him in schooling. As he told Gertrude, the enrollment of members from other churches was what pleased him most. Someday all the churches will get together and be one again, the way Jesus intended. There were different sects in the Jewish faith when he lived, and he didn't approve of them. There are more Christian sects now than there were believers in the Lord when he was crucified. "I don't think he'd like that," Gertrude agreed. "I don't think he'd like what happened to Christianity at all." Edgar took a job working for his father, going from town to town selling insurance. Early in March 1900, he arrived in Elkton, a small town about 40 miles from Hopkinsville. For several weeks, on and off, he had been suffering from severe headaches. One morning, the pain was particularly bad, and he stopped at a doctor's office and asked for a sedative. The doctor gave him a powder and told him to take it with a glass of water, and he went back to his hotel and swallowed the dose. When next he was conscious, he was at home in Hopkinsville, in bed. A friend of the family had found him in the railroad station in Elkton, wandering around in a daze. Edgar tried to ask questions, but his voice had dwindled to a faint, painful whisper. They gave him a gargle, but it didn't help. Two doctors examined him and said that, except for his hoarseness, he was all right. The sedative had apparently been too strong and had shocked his nervous system. Probably his sore throat came from wandering around the streets on a cold day. They advised him to rest. The next day he was up and about, ready to get back to work. But the hoarseness hadn't improved. Nor was it any better the next day or the next. A team of specialists examined him, but the hoarseness remained. Months went by, and finally Edgar had to face the fact that his condition might never change. He had to find a new job. Salesmanship was impossible for a man without a voice. So was clerking. So it seemed was anything he knew how to do. The local photographer solved the problem. He offered Edgar a job as an apprentice, and Edgar accepted. Gertrude was delighted. She had always been interested in photography and painting. "We can have our own studio. I'll receive the people and tend to all the business of talking to them and showing them samples and prices, and you can take the pictures and do the developing. I can do the tinting, too." But there was still a problem. In the quiet of the studio darkroom, in the solitude of his walks, in the time of prayer before going to sleep, he was haunted by questions. Had his voice been taken from him because it was meant to be the voice of a preacher? Was he being punished for not heeding the call to serve God? The angel who had appeared to him when he was a child, who had directed him from the farm to Hopkinsville, had she sent him on a mission? A mission he had failed to fulfill? She had said to him, "Your prayers have been heard. Tell me what you would like most of all, so that I may give it to you." And he had answered, "Most of all, I would like to be helpful to others, especially to the children when they're sick." Then she'd disappeared. And the next day, she'd helped him with his lessons. Why had she helped him with his lessons if she had not meant him to study and be a preacher? Or, as his mother had thought, a doctor? But these things had been impossible. He had done the best he knew how. He had taught Sunday school, formed a mission group, and tried to live like a true Christian. Was there something else he should have done? Everyone in Hopkinsville went to Holland's Opera House when Hart, the Laugh King, came to town. Hart was a hypnotist. He got his laughs by putting people under and telling them to do ridiculous things like play hopscotch or imitate fish and climb non-existent ladders. Usually, he asked for a group to go up on stage. Those who did not respond to being put to sleep were dismissed, while the others amused the audience. Once Edgar went up with a group of his friends, but he was dismissed. Hart wore no robes, used no lights or other paraphernalia, and credited his powers to what he called the new science of hypnotism and clairvoyance. When he heard from some of the townspeople about Edgar's trouble, he accepted it as a challenge. For $200, he said he would cure the hoarseness. The experiment was conducted in Dr. Brown's office. Edgar sat in an easy chair. Hart selected a shiny object from the doctor's instrument tray. "Look at this. Watch it closely. You are going to sleep. Sleep. Sleep." When next Edgar was aware of what was going on, they were all smiling at him. Dr. Brown, the squire, and Hart. Hart spoke. "Say something." "Did I go under all right?" His voice was a hoarse whisper. The smiles faded. He had talked quite normally while he was hypnotized. Hart said that it was because he hadn't taken the post-suggestion. "We'll try again. After you've had a rest, you talked. That's the important thing." They tried again that afternoon. And when Edgar awoke, he was still hoarse, though he had talked again while under. They asked him how his throat felt. Dr. Brown examined it. There was no change in its condition. It still seemed normal, as it had seemed to be during all the time of the affliction. Hart was puzzled. He gets to the second stage of hypnosis, and then something happens. He won't go beyond it, to the third stage, where he would take post-suggestion. But I'm sure he will eventually. We'll keep trying. Everyone in town knew about the experiments, and the local paper printed accounts of them. Professor William Garreau, who taught psychology at South Kentucky College, asked permission to attend the meetings. He was quiet during the proceedings, making notes and occasionally asking a question of Hart. In the end, Hart had to give up. Theatrical bookings took him away from Hopkinsville, and although he returned for another try, whenever he was in the vicinity, he admitted that he had failed. Garreau wrote an account of the experiments and sent it with some clippings from Hopkinsville to Dr. John P. Quackenboss in New York. Hypnotism was enjoying a fad throughout the country at this time, and Quackenboss had said that he believed that one day it would be used in place of medicine by directing the unconscious mind to remove the cause of suffering. Quackenboss expressed interest in Edgar's case, and one day in autumn he turned up in Hopkinsville, ready to try his skill on Edgar. He had no more luck than Hart. Edgar would not go beyond the second stage to take post-suggestion. In a final effort, Quackenboss set about inducing a very, very deep sleep. Edgar slept for 24 hours, impervious to all efforts to awaken him. Everyone was frightened, and most of the doctors in town gathered for consultation. When the patient awoke, it was naturally, as if it were morning. He said he felt fine, though his voice was no better. For days afterward, he could not sleep at all, except for cat naps. Then he got over it, and Dr. Quackenboss, relieved but still puzzled, left town. From New York, he wrote to Garreau that he was convinced there was a solution to the case. At the point where Edgar refused to take further suggestion, he seemed to take charge of things himself. If the hypnotist were to suggest at that point that the patient talk about his own case, something interesting might result. Such things had been reported in France. Many years before, patients under hypnosis showed powers of clairvoyance. It was worth a try. The only hypnotist in town was Al C. Lane. He had studied suggestive therapeutics and osteopathy by means of correspondence courses. He had followed the accounts of the experiments in Dr. Brown's office with the greatest interest, and now asked if he could try to hypnotize Edgar. Edgar was willing, but his parents objected. He had been losing weight ever since the first experiment. He was nervous and high-strung. The squire was afraid that further experiments would harm Edgar. Edgar asked for a compromise. Let Lane try one experiment, following the suggestions made by Dr. Quackenboss. If this didn't bring results, he would submit to no more hypnotizing. The date was set for March 31, 1901. Edgar suggested that he put himself to sleep, as he had done when sleeping on his books, and that Lane then attempt to talk to him. Lane agreed with the idea of self-hypnosis, or as he called it, auto-hypnosis. Edgar lay down on the family couch and put himself to sleep. The squire sat in a chair nearby. Lane began to talk in a low, soothing voice, suggesting that Edgar see his body and describe the trouble in the throat. He suggested that Edgar speak in a normal tone of voice. In a few minutes, Edgar began to mumble. Then he cleared his voice and began to speak in a clear, unafflicted voice. Yes, we can see the body. In a normal state, this body is unable to speak due to a partial paralysis of the inferior muscles of the vocal cords produced by nerve strain. This is a psychological condition producing a physical effect. This may be removed by increasing the circulation of the affected parts by suggestion while in this unconscious condition. Lane spoke. The circulation to the affected parts will now increase, and the condition will be removed. Edgar was silent. They watched his throat. The squire leaned over and further loosened Edgar's shirt. Gradually, the upper part of the chest, then the throat, turned pink. The pink deepened to a rose. The rose became a violent red. 20 minutes passed. Edgar cleared his throat again. It's all right now. The condition is removed. Make the suggestion that the circulation return to normal, and that after that, the body awaken. Lane spoke. The circulation will return to normal. The body will then awaken. They watched while the red faded back through rose to pink. The skin resumed its normal color. Edgar wakened, sat up, and reached for his handkerchief. He coughed and spat blood, then spoke tentatively. Hello. Then he grinned.
I can talk. I'm all right.
His mother wept. His father seized his hand and shook it again and again. Good boy. Good boy. Good boy. They went into the kitchen to write down what had been said. Edgar kept trying his voice. Lane was excited. This is the greatest thing that's ever happened to you, Edgar. But it may be the greatest thing that's happened to the rest of us, too. If you can do this for yourself, why can't you do it for others? Edgar was elated and grateful to Lane.
I'm willing to try.
Lane proposed that they try it the next day, on him. I've been ailing with a stomach trouble for years. I've had all kinds of doctors look at me. I know their diagnosis. I'll be able to tell whether you are describing the right symptoms and how close you come to the right kind of treatment. Well, the next afternoon, Lane arrived with a series of questions he had written concerning his condition. Edgar declined to read them, saying that they wouldn't mean anything to him anyway. As on the previous day, he put himself to sleep. Lane sat by, holding a pad and pencil. When Edgar woke up, Lane waved the pad at him gleefully. You went all over me, gave me a perfect diagnosis, told me how I feel and what to do, medicines, a diet, a set of exercises. If it works, our fortunes are made. Edgar looked at what Lane had written down. How can I tell you these things? I've never heard of most of the names you have here. I've never studied physiology or biology or chemistry or anatomy. I've never even worked in a drugstore. Are these patent medicines? Lane explained that some were patent medicines, while some were simple mixtures that didn't require a prescription. He went out and got the medicines and started scheduling the medication. In a week, he was so improved that he wanted to begin experiments on other people. But Edgar was reluctant. He was afraid he might harm someone. But Lane reassured him. There's no chance of that. I know enough about medicine to tell whether a thing is dangerous. Besides, medicines that might be poisonous or have narcotics in them require a doctor's prescription. We couldn't get them filled even if you prescribed them. So you'll have to give simple remedies. If you name a medicine that I can't get, I'll ask you to name a substitute that is obtainable. Edgar agreed to try someone else on the condition that he not be told who that person was. After the attempt was made, Lane informed him that the diagnosis had been perfect. Lane set about renting an office. Months passed. Lane opened his office with Edgar. Edgar is a silent partner, doing the diagnosing and refusing to take any money. His father often came to the experiments, and it was a comfort to Edgar to know that a third person was there keeping an eye on what went on. Lane found that he had to tell Edgar where the people were at the time of the diagnosis. Some were in the outer office. While unknown to them, the experiments went on. Others came for an examination and were told to return in a few days for a diagnosis and an outline of treatment. Meanwhile, they were checked on by Edgar. Lane called the experiments readings and described Edgar's sleep state as self-imposed hypnotic trance, which induces clairvoyance. The patients, according to Lane, improved under the treatments, and many were cured. He himself was immediately better, and there was no doubt about that. But Edgar was still worried. One dead patient was all that was needed to make him a murderer. In May 1902, he was offered a job in a bookstore in Bowling Green. Although he was now a full-fledged photographer working for Mr. Bowles, he decided to take the job. He wanted to get away from Hopkinsville, from Lane, from the readings. It might be all right to give them, but he wasn't sure. He wanted time to think things over. What worried him most of all was that Lane was not a physician. With a doctor's approval and under a doctor's supervision, he would not have been afraid to try any kind of experiment. With a correspondence school healer, that was different. Bowling Green was a pretty little city, 10,000 people. He took a room in a boarding house on State Street. His dormitory mates were two doctors, a dentist, and several other young professional men. He joined the church and began making friends. But after 2 weeks, his voice began to fade. He took the night train, went to Lane's office, the next morning, and put himself to sleep. When he awakened, his voice was normal. Lane offered to visit him at Bowling Green to help maintain his voice. While he was there, he said, he would also ask about his patients. Edgar felt he had no choice but to agree. At first, Lane came twice a month, but soon the visits were weekly. Edgar dared not tell any of his young doctor friends about it, or anyone else in Bowling Green, for that matter. Late in the summer, he received a telephone call from Hopkinsville. It was from C.H. Dietrich, a former school superintendent. "Mr. Lane has told me of the things you have done for some of his patients. I have a little girl who's been ill a long time. No one seems to be able to help her. There'll be a ticket waiting for you in the railroad station if you'll come over here Sunday and see what you can do for her. I'll meet you at the station." Edgar agreed to go. In Hopkinsville, Mr. Dietrich met him at the station. On the way to the house, he explained that his daughter, Amy, had been ill for 3 years. She was now 5, and since the age of 2, after an attack of grip, her mind hadn't developed. She had been taken to many specialists. None had been able to cure her or stop the convulsions, which attacked her in increasing numbers. When they reached the house, Dietrich asked Edgar if he wanted to see the child, and Edgar said no, and lay down on the sofa and put himself to sleep. When he awakened, Mrs. Dietrich was weeping. "Mr. Casey, you've given us the first hope we've had. You'll just have to stay and see whether Mr. Lane makes the adjustments properly." Edgar stared at her. "What did I say?" "You told us that she slipped and struck the end of her spine while getting out of the carriage a few days before catching grip. The grip germs settled in her spine and caused the attacks. Mr. Lane is to make some osteopathic adjustments, and she'll recover. I'll call your employer and ask him to let you off." Edgar looked at Lane, and he thought about jail. "Mail order osteopath and somnambulist partner jailed for medical fraud," the papers would say. But Mrs. Dietrich was looking at him, waiting for his answer. In a voice that was barely audible, he agreed. After several adjustments, Lane took what he called a check reading. The adjustments were said to be successful. Edgar left that afternoon for Bowling Green. When Lane arrived the following Sunday, he had good news. The Dietrich child was responding. She had suddenly called the name of a doll she had been fond of before her attacks began. A day after that, she had called her mother by name, then her father. She was picking up where she had left off before the illness had made her mind go blank. At the end of 3 weeks, Lane took a check reading on the case. The child, Edgar reported, was developing normally and would continue to do so. The condition that had caused the illness was corrected. No further treatments were necessary. After 3 months, Mrs. Dietrich told Lane that her daughter was normal in all respects and was rapidly covering the educational ground that separated her from other children her age. There had been no recurrence of the attacks. They were married on June 17, 1903. It was 6 years, 3 months, and 3 days since they had become engaged. He rented a room for them in Bowling Green, right across from his former boarding house. They were to take their meals there. When they crossed the street for dinner the next day, Gertrude was surprised to see Lane sitting in the front room. When she asked what Lane was doing there, Edgar sheepishly explained. At the dinner table, she was cool to Lane. Judge Roop, an occasional boarder, noticed it. He was curious about Lane, having seen him at the table on many Sundays. He spoke up casually. Mr. Lane, they tell me you're a doctor." John Blackburn, a medical doctor, and his brother James, a dentist, looked up. Hugh Beasley, also a medical doctor, looked up. Judge Roop went on. "Tell me, how is it that you favor Bowling Green with a visit almost every Sunday?" Lane met his eyes. "I come to see Edgar." "Is he sick?" Lane looked at Edgar, who was looking at his plate. "Well, Edgar doesn't like to talk about it, but I came here to ask him about my patients. He's gifted with a very unusual power. He has the ability to hypnotize himself, and while he's in that state, he is clairvoyant. He can see other people and diagnose their ailments. He cured himself of aphonia, after being unable to speak above a whisper for a year. He cured me of an illness that bothered me for years. He's helped many others. If you wish, I'll let him show you a demonstration this afternoon. I'm sure you'll say it's the most unusual thing you've ever seen. They went upstairs to Beasley's room, and Lane told the story of his experiments, including the Dietrich case. Then Edgar put himself to sleep. When he awakened, his friends looked at him with speculation and wonder. John Blackburn turned to Lane. Dr. Lane, are you going to give the medicines mentioned in that reading? Well, yes, I am. Blackburn looked at him. Dr. Lane, what medical school did you attend? Well, I haven't been to any school. I've studied a lot by myself. But most of what I know has come from Edgar during the past 2 years, while he's been asleep. Why does Edgar mix up his treatments so? There are many schools of medicine. Allopathic, homeopathic, naturopathic, osteopathic. Edgar seems to use them all. That doesn't make sense. Well, I think it does. Some people need one form of treatment, some another. No one school has all the answers. They talked on and on, until Lane had to leave to catch his train. Then they questioned Edgar. The next evening, there was an article in the Bowling Green Times Journal by Judge Roop telling of the previous day's experiment. The Nashville papers copied the story. Edgar prepared himself to be questioned and stared at, as he had been in Hopkinsville. Lane made 2 more visits to Bowling Green. Then, at the request of the medical authorities of the state, he closed his office and discontinued practice. He wrote Edgar that he was leaving immediately for Franklin, Kentucky, to enter the Southern School of Osteopathy and prepare himself to be a collaborator in the readings. Edgar was relieved. But a week later, he began to lose his voice again. He appealed to John Blackburn. To his surprise, Blackburn agreed right away. He was curious to try the experiment. Edgar wrote out the suggestions to be given for regaining his voice. Then he went to sleep. They were alone in Blackburn's office. When he awakened, Blackburn was pale and trembling. You did it. I watched the blood go up into your chest and throat. Then I saw it come back down again. As soon as you went to sleep, you talked normally. Your voice is all right now. And you woke up when I told you to. I thought all that stuff with Lane was hooey. Well, this was no fake. I saw it happen. What does it all mean? Edgar shook his head. I wish I knew. A few days later, a letter arrived from Mr. Andrews, a New York man, for whom Edgar had prescribed something called Clary Water when he had been helping Lane. The patient had been unable to find it, and although he had inquired at all the leading drug houses, he had advertised for it in the medical journals. But in the meantime, why couldn't Edgar go to sleep and tell him where it could be found, or what ingredients it was made of? Edgar showed the letter to Blackburn. Blackburn suggested that they try the experiment. He and Beasley had discussed Edgar with some of their colleagues. They were thinking of forming a committee to investigate the phenomenon, if Edgar would cooperate. Some of the doctors were present when Blackburn conducted the check reading for Mr. Andrews. When Edgar awakened, Blackburn had the formula for Clary Water, and it was written down. Sounds like a powerful tonic. Garden sage water's the base. That's what Clary Water is, garden sage. Then ambergris, dissolved in grain alcohol. Then some gin and some cinnamon. Edgar shook his head. Lordy, what a dose! Blackburn told him that it couldn't hurt anyone. The other doctors all agreed. Blackburn explained his plan. We'll send this to Mr. Andrews and get his report on its effect. I'll mix up some, too. If it's really a good tonic, we want to find out all we can about it. We'll investigate it thoroughly and let you know if you belong in a circus or an institution, eh, boys? They laughed, and Edgar laughed with them. Whatever happened now, he was being looked after by the right kind of people. They would not allow him to harm others through the readings, and they would not allow his strange power to harm him. They would find out what it was and what should be done with it. Edgar made plans to open his own photographer studio. He found a partner, a distant cousin of the man who owned the bookstore where he worked. Well, one day, just after he had made this decision, he received a letter from Mr. Andrews in New York. Andrews had received a letter from a man in Paris. The man had read Mr. Andrews' advertisement for clary water in a medical journal and had written to say that he knew it was unavailable because his father had been the manufacturer. It had not been made or sold now for many years. However, the son had the formula and would gladly give it to Mr. Andrews so that he could make the tonic himself. A copy of the prescription was enclosed. It was identical with the one given by Edgar in his reading. Mr. Andrews was taking the mixture and feeling better. Edgar read the letter to Blackburn. The doctor stroked his beard. "Reckon we'd better begin those experiments." John Blackburn stood in the doorway of the photography studio dressing room. On a sofa, in a position similar to the one he usually assumed while giving a reading, lay Edgar. He seemed lifeless. Blood had clotted on his lips. Around him stood a dozen doctors. Two of them were members of the investigating group that Blackburn had organized to examine Edgar. Blackburn approached the sofa and looked down at the body. "What happened? What happened?" One of the doctors explained. Edgar had worked all day taking photographs in a coal factory. He had come back to the studio darkroom. Then he had sat by the stove to try and warm up. Suddenly, he had slumped over and passed out. Two boys who worked for him had run for a doctor. The doctor had tried to pour whiskey down his throat, but found that his jaws were locked. The doctor had pried open his jaws, breaking two of his front teeth in the process. Then he had given him a morphine shot. When nothing happened, he sent for more doctors. One of them had given him an injection of strychnine, another an injection of morphine. They had put hot bricks wrapped in towels against his body and placed hot stove lids against the soles of his feet. Still, there had been no sign of life. Blackburn was worried. The stuff that's in him would kill him, even if he'd been all right to start out with. He sat down on a sofa and began to talk to Edgar. He suggested that his pulse increase, that his blood circulate, that he wake up. Over and over he repeated the admonitions. Nothing happened. One by one, the doctors left. All of them had given Edgar up for dead. After half an hour, all of the doctors were gone except for Blackburn and the two who belonged to the investigating group. Suddenly, one of Edgar's muscles twitched. His pulse became detectable. His breathing became noticeable. With a deep groan, he woke up. Pain racked his body. His mouth was full of blood. He realized that some of his teeth were gone. The soles of his feet were blistered. His arms were so sore from the hypodermic injections that he could scarcely move them. Blackburn told him what had happened and asked him what to do. Edgar groaned. "I don't know. Let me go back to sleep and see if you can talk it out of me." He put himself to sleep and Blackburn began to talk again. He suggested that normal conditions return to all parts of the body, that healing of the sore spots be speeded and pain be removed, and that whatever poisons were already in the system be thrown off. Blackburn had noticed that where the hypodermics had been administered, the flesh of the arms was discolored and swollen. The doses had not yet been absorbed. He tried injecting a needle and withdrawing the plunger. Most of the stuff came out. Now an hour passed. The pulse again receded. There was no sign of life. The two other doctors left. Another hour passed. A muscle twitched. Again the pulse became detectable. Breathing became noticeable. Again Edgar woke up. "I feel better. I think I'm all right." Most of the pain had gone. But he was sore from head to foot. His feet were so sore, he could not tie the laces of his shoes. Blackburn bundled him up and drove him home in his buggy. He asked Edgar what had happened, and Edgar didn't know. "I was tired and cold. I hadn't stopped to eat much. I was sitting by the stove getting warm, and that's all I remember." Blackburn had a theory. I wonder if that crazy mind of yours didn't put you to sleep because you needed a rest. It looks after other people's health when we ask it to. Why shouldn't it look after yours? Edgar laughed weakly. If it's going to do tricks like that, I wish it would tell me, so I can go to bed and not have all the doctors in town trying to wake me up. In the morning, he was awakened by the sound of the front doorbell. A messenger boy handed him a large floral piece. The card, edged in black, began, "With deepest sympathy." Blackburn and his group began to observe Edgar's readings. They intended to record the details. They were well aware of the medical profession's opinion of clairvoyance, but they were also familiar with such American books as Thomas J. Hudson's The Law of Psychic Phenomena and knew something about the studies of clairvoyance and somnambulism that had been going on in Europe for more than a century. In the 18th century, a man named Maxwell had said, "There is no disease which is not curable by a spirit of life without help of a physician. The universal remedy is nothing but the spirit of life increased in a suitable subject." Franz Mesmer found a means of stimulating this natural healing force and called the process magnetism. In 1784, de Puysegur, attempting to magnetize a shepherd boy called Victor, discovered hypnotism. Victor, falling into a deep trance, began to speak and diagnosed the ailment of a person next to him. During the next generation, people with similar sensitiveness were found in France, Germany, and England. They were studied carefully. The best men of science gave them their attention and wrote books about them. Somnambulism became fashionable. People went by preference to a somnambulist rather than to a physician, and the results were apparently as efficacious as they were amazing. The somnambulists seemed infallible in diagnosis, and the remedies they suggested were simple and, according to the evidence, helpful. It is not surprising that people in time preferred a clairvoyant to a doctor. The medical profession of the day was in a state of dark ignorance. Somnambulists, on the other hand, seldom prescribed anything dangerous and frequently stated that the trouble was psychological and could be corrected by suggestion. The material on somnambulism that was gathered and printed during the first half of the century would seem to be overwhelming proof of the reality of the phenomenon. Dr. Justinus Kerner, for example, wrote about Frau Hauff, the seeress of Prevorst, a somnambulist so sensitive that upon approaching a patient, and even before contact, but still more after it, she experienced the same feeling and in the same place as the patient, to the great astonishment of the latter, and could exactly describe all his sufferings without his having given her any previous verbal information. As the books on somnambulism rolled off the presses, orthodox medicine rallied to the opposition. Mesmer was condemned as a fraud, and the diverse phenomena discovered by other investigators were damned along with him. The hope for a new system of diagnosing physical ills, a system already inherent in man and magically sure, began to fade. 75 years later, somnambulism was all but forgotten. Orthodox medicine was on the verge of a great era. Thus, when the Blackburn brothers and their colleagues took up the study of the intuitive somnambulist Edgar Cayce, they reported him with the same skepticism which had prevailed in their profession a century before. Edgar was asked to give a reading for the mother of a local dentist. She lived in a nearby town. The name and the address were read to him after he had gone to sleep. He diagnosed her ailment and outlined a system of treatment. He then was asked to describe the room in which the woman lay. He told what color the walls were painted, what pictures were on them, where the windows were located, and where the bed was situated. He located the origin of the steel in the bed springs, mentioned where the cotton and the mattress had been grown, and listed the cities in which the various sections of the bed had been manufactured. The doctors checked the information as far as they could. The description of the room was correct in every detail. They were, however, unable to trace the steel, the cotton, and the wood in the bed. There were other readings, but they had an irritating habit of turning out the same way. Correct. a Bowling Green man wrote to an acquaintance in New York, describing Edgar's powers. The man said the whole thing was a fraud. As an experiment, a reading was taken on him one morning. Edgar was told to find him in New York and to trace his progress through the streets as he approached his office. Edgar trailed him to a cigar store, then to his office, read part of his mail, and reported on a portion of a telephone conversation. The text of the reading was immediately telegraphed to the man. He wired back, "You are exactly right. I am coming to Bowling Green." He did come, and tried to induce Edgar to go back with him to New York. They would, he said, make $1 million. Edgar refused. In the autumn of 1906, Edgar was invited to give a reading at a local club as a demonstration of hypnotism. Most of the local doctors were to be there, as well as the physicians from surrounding localities. At the meeting, Edgar went to sleep on a couch that was placed before the dais. He was given the name and address of a college student who was ill in a dormitory just outside the city. The boy was a patient of one of the doctors present. Edgar began to speak. "Yes, we have the body. He is recovering from an attack of typhoid fever. The pulse is 96. The temperature, 101.4. The doctor in charge of the patient said the diagnosis was correct. A committee of three was dispatched to check on the temperature and pulse. While they were gone, an argument arose as to what state of consciousness or unconsciousness Edgar was in. Some said hypnosis, some said trance, some said a dream state. The doctors who were witnessing their first reading wanted to find out. Over Blackburn's violent protests, one of them stuck a needle in Edgar's arms, hands, and feet. There was no response. Another left the room, returned with a hatpin, and before Blackburn could stop him, thrust it entirely through Edgar's cheeks. Still, there was no response. Then another doctor opened a penknife and ran the blade under Edgar's left forefinger. Slowly, the nail was lifted away from the flesh. There was no indication of pain. No blood flowed. The knife was withdrawn. Suddenly, Edgar woke up. Immediately, he felt pain. The doctors began to apologize. "Just a few scientific tests," they said. No harm was meant. Edgar lost his temper. He turned on Blackburn and the other doctors. "I'm through. I've let you do anything you want to do with me. I've given you my time and never asked you even to be polite enough to think me sincere. I thought you wanted to find out the truth, but you don't. Nothing will convince any of you. No matter how many miracles you see, you never will believe anything that will interfere with your own smugness. You take it for granted that every man in the world is crooked except yourselves, and you will accept no proof of anyone's honesty. I'll never try to prove anything to any of you again. I'll never give another reading unless it's for someone who needs help and believes I can give it to him." And he walked out. In March 1907, Gertrude and Edgar became parents. The baby was a boy, and he was given the name Hugh Lynn. Gertrude's sister, Carrie Salter, and her husband, Dr. Thomas House, came to Bowling Green to spend the winter. Carrie helped Gertrude with the new baby while Dr. House was on vacation. Edgar, meanwhile, was working as much as possible. Two fires in his studios had put him in debt. He had decided also that he wanted to leave Bowling Green and make a fresh start in another town. Carrie and Dr. House returned to Hopkinsville in the spring. One evening in late May, Dr. House called Edgar. "Carrie's sick, and she wants you to come over here and give a reading for her. I've had Dr. Haggard up from Nashville, and he wants to operate. But she won't do a thing without getting your consent. You better come over. She's pretty badly off." Edgar took the night train. All the way to Hopkinsville, he prayed. Carrie had always had faith in him and his readings. She had insisted that the power was a gift of God. Was her faith justified? The next morning, facing the couple in the living room, he was frightened. Carrie was obviously quite sick and in pain, but her faith was unwavering. "A reading will tell what's wrong with me and what to do for it. Get it as soon as you can, Edgar." Edgar went into one of the bedrooms and put himself to sleep, first instructing Dr. House about the suggestions, especially the one about waking him up. That, he discovered, was the only important point about the phenomenon. Anyone could conduct a reading, so long as the proper suggestion for waking was given, and the conductor was careful not to move away from the sleeping body while the trance persisted. When he awakened, Dr. House looked glum. Dr. Haggard thinks she has a tumor of the abdomen. I've had all the local doctors in. They all agree with the diagnosis. You say there is no tumor and the trouble is in a locked bowel. What you suggest for the locked bowel sounds reasonable. Warm oil enemas and some other things. But I don't see how she can be pregnant. She's not supposed to be able to have children. But I'm going to try these things anyway. We'll see what happens. Edgar felt miserable. He had hoped that he would agree with the doctors. It would have made things so much easier. He stayed there that day and night. The next morning, Dr. House came from Carrie's bedroom and shook his hand. You were right about the locked bowel. She's better now. But I don't see how it can be a pregnancy. Edgar returned to Bowling Green. The following November, Thomas House, Jr., was born. A 7-month baby. He was so small and fragile that he was carried around on a pillow. No one but Carrie believed that he would survive the winter. He was sick most of the time and inclined to convulsions. One day in March, he had so many that Carrie asked Dr. House to call Edgar. This time, when he arrived, there were two local doctors present besides Dr. House. One of them refused to stay when he saw Edgar. Dr. Jackson, who had long been the Casey family doctor, remained. Carrie was sitting in a rocker in the living room. In her lap lay the baby, convulsing, regularly every 20 minutes. Edgar went into the bedroom across the hall. Dr. House and Dr. Jackson followed him. He lay on the bed and went to sleep. When he woke, Dr. House was sitting beside him. Dr. Jackson was in the living room, and Edgar could hear him talking to Carrie. Now, Mrs. House, you can't do what that man tells you to do. What he says to give your child is poison. Edgar walked in and stood by the fireplace. Carrie kept rocking, staring down at the baby. Dr. House came in and sat beside her. Carrie spoke to Jackson. You're one of the doctors who told me I had to have an operation, aren't you? I didn't have one. Now my baby's dying, and you can't help him. But you don't want me to do what Edgar says. Well, I'm going to do it. Dr. House spoke to her coaxingly. What he prescribes is an overdose of belladonna. You know yourself how poisonous that is. Of course, he gives an antidote. But how do we know it'll work? But Carrie was determined. The only thing we know is that the baby's going to die if we don't do something. This is our only chance. Measure out the dose, and I'll give it to him myself. And get the antidote ready. Dr. House went to his room and came back with the belladonna. Carrie administered it. In a few minutes, the baby relaxed, stretched, and went to sleep. Jackson turned to Edgar. You gave something else. A peach tree poultice. I don't know how to make it, or what good it will do. But you described it. You better go ahead and fix it. Edgar went out to the orchard, glad to be out of the living room. Standing there, watching the baby as it lay in Carrie's arms, waiting for it to live or die, was more than he could bear. What could a peach tree poultice be? It couldn't be made of leaves, for every limb in the orchard was bare. He climbed up one of the peach trees and picked off the youngest, tenderest branches. They would make a good brew, if that's what it was meant. He took them to the kitchen and put them in a pot, pouring hot water from a kettle over them. When the brew seemed strong enough, he dipped towels in it, rinsed them, and carried them into the living room. Endless hours dragged by. Then as he brought a fresh batch of towels into the living room, Carrie looked up at him and said, "He's all right. I knew if anyone could save him, you could, Edgar." He went outside and stood in the cold night, taking deep breaths. Dr. House joined him. "Well, you saved Carrie, and now you've saved the boy with this trance business of yours. Still sounds like foolishness, but I'm afraid I'll have to believe it now." Standing under the winter sky, watching the stars and knowing he had done a good thing, Edgar believed in it too. He felt that he understood himself for the first time. He had saved a human being, a child, from suffering, perhaps from death, by the use of a power that had been given to him by God. It was his greatest dream come true. But back in Bowling Green, his bursts of faith passed, seeing the doctors who attempted to expose him bogged him in melancholy. He spent all his time and energy working to pay off his debts. In August of 1909, the last bill was paid and receipted. After 7 years of labor, he was completely broke. During the holidays, the squire took him to meet Dr. Wesley Ketchum, a homeopath who had opened an office in Hopkinsville. Homeopaths were numerous and popular at that time. They were called spoon-up and spoon-down doctors, owing to their custom of giving medicine in small and frequent doses. The homeopaths mixed their own prescriptions. Ketchum had heard of the readings and wanted to see one. Edgar told him he no longer gave them for exhibition purposes, and that he would only give one if Ketchum came with a written request from a person who needed help. They were in Ketchum's office. He went across the street to the hotel and in a few minutes came back waving a paper. "I have it. The person needs help very much." Edgar agreed to do the reading. The squire gave the suggestions. When Edgar woke up, Ketchum was standing there chuckling. "Well, that beats anything I've ever seen. You know, that would fool anybody but a fellow like me. You say I think I've got appendicitis? Man, I know I've got it. I've been examined by 6 of the best doctors in the state. I'm going to be operated on next Wednesday. But you said I fell over a box and hurt myself. And that if I go to an osteopath, he'll fix me up. My boy, you're a fake. You're so smooth. You'll fool anybody but me. If you'll tie up with me, we can go all over the country and make a fortune." Edgar was boiling with rage. "If it's a fake, it's not my fake. I don't know anything about it. If I'm a fake, I dare you to prove it. And if you do, I'll never give another reading as long as I live." Edgar and the squire left the office. Ketchum followed them soon, going up the street to the office of Dr. Oldham, the local osteopath. He asked Oldham to examine him. Ketchum lay on his stomach, and Oldham examined his spine, pressing on the various vertebrae. "Do you have a pain in your right side?" Ketchum said he did. Oldham pressed 2 vertebrae. "There's a lesion here, probably caused by a fall or a strain. I'll get my wife in here to hold your feet while I give your back a twist." That night, Edgar and the squire went back to Ketchum's office. At his request, he waved them to a seat and looked Edgar in the eyes. "You're not a fake. I have been a fool. Oldham agreed with your diagnosis, and after he treated me, the pain went away. You should team up with me, Edgar. I didn't mean that what I said earlier, but I do now. We can do a lot of good for people and make a fortune for ourselves. We can find new cures for diseases. We can revolutionize medicine. What do you say?" Edgar shook his head, still angry. "Nothing doing. I'm glad you discovered your mistake. You found out I'm not a fake like all the other doctors who've investigated me. Now, if you fellas could convince me that you all are not fakes, maybe I'd join up with you." In October 1910, Edgar was working at night in a photography studio in Montgomery, Alabama. A man knocked on the door and asked for Edgar Casey. "We've been looking all over for you. You're famous." He pulled a fistful of clippings from his pocket. "New York Times, St. Louis Dispatch, Denver Post, Kansas City Star." He handed the clippings to Edgar. The first one was from the New York Times. Edgar saw photographs of himself and Ketchum. The headline read, "Illiterate man becomes a doctor when hypnotized. Strange power shown by Edgar Casey. Puzzles physicians." Edgar sank into a chair and began to read. "The medical fraternity of the country is taking a lively interest in the strange power said to be possessed by Edgar Casey. Dr. W.H. Ketchum discussed the man's case at a meeting of the National Society of Homeopathic Physicians, and one of the leading Boston medical men who heard his speech invited Dr. Ketchum to prepare a paper for the American Society of Clinical Research." Edgar read all the clippings, trying to figure out what had happened. In all, Casey has given more than 1,000 readings. Probably he had, but not for Ketchum. Some of the cases reported were Lane's cases. There was a description of the Dietrich experience, for example. Apparently, Ketchum, on a visit to California, had told some tall tales, and when asked to elaborate, in a scientific paper, had rounded up all the available evidence in Hopkinsville. What interested Edgar most was the explanation of the phenomenon, which he was supposed to have given in a reading. When asked to give the source of his knowledge, he stated, "Edgar Cayce's mind is amenable to suggestion, but it has the power to interpret to the objective mind of others what it acquires from the subconscious mind of other individuals. The subconscious mind forgets nothing. His subconscious mind is in direct communication with all other subconscious minds, gathering in this way all the knowledge possessed by millions of other subconscious minds." So that was it. Well, it didn't mean much, because it didn't tell why he could do what others could not. Apparently, his mind was not different from others, except that it could work backward. If all people were like him, they could all be hypnotized and would then be able to send back through the conscious mind what their subconscious mind knew. Apparently, God did not intend it that way. He made man to walk through the world in darkness except for what he learned by experience and what he believed by faith. Edgar went to his desk and got his mail. There was a letter from Ketchum. He offered no explanation for what he had done. Instead, he urged Edgar to come back to Hopkinsville and make a business of giving readings. A company would be formed, Ketchum, the Squire, and Albert Noe, owner of a hotel in Hopkinsville. We're already in partnership on the deal. All they wanted to know was what terms he would accept for his services. They would agree to do anything reasonable. Edgar snapped off the light and sat in the dark studio. He had to make a decision about his power. Obviously, it was not meant that he help only a select few, such as the members of his family or those who heard about him from people who had been helped, like the Dietrichs. It was a gift of God, destined for everyone. But a gift of God could be controlled by the devil. When he used his talent, he was asleep. How would he know whether his mind was up to good or evil? Blackburn had always contended that his sleep mind contained his conscious mind and could not be led astray. He pointed to Edgar's collapse in Bowling Green after working in the coal factory all day. That was an example, he said, of the guardianship of the sleep mind over the body. On the other hand, Edgar himself had said in a reading that his mind was amenable to suggestion. Suppose it was told to do something wrong. His only safeguard was to pray for guidance and help from God. He opened his Bible to Psalm 46. God is our refuge and our strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore will we not fear, though the earth be removed and though the mountains be carried into the midst of the sea. Though the waters thereof roar and be troubled, though the mountains shake with the swelling thereof, there is a river, the streams whereof shall make glad the city of God. He stopped reading and began a letter to Ketchum. On certain conditions, I will accept your offer. It is to be understood that my father will act as conductor of all readings, and that a stenographic account of all that is said to be taken down, and at least two copies of it will be made, one for the patient and one for our files. No readings are to be given except for sick people who make the request themselves. Furthermore, it must be understood that I am not to consider this as a profession or a means of livelihood. The company which has been formed is to completely equip me for a photographic studio, which is to be mine to conduct as a means of my livelihood. The company is to equip another office for the readings, which I will give twice a day. When they received the letter, Ketchum, the Squire, and Noe wired Edgar to come to Hopkinsville at once. When he arrived, they showed him the mail. Nearly 10,000 letters. Some of them contained money. There was more than $2,000 in cash. Edgar insisted that it all be sent back. They set about drawing up a contract. Edgar and his father would divide 50% of the gross receipts. Noe and Ketchum would receive the rest and pay the rent and all the expenses from it. Then there was a special reading at which a number of judges and lawyers were present. They were asked about the legality of their enterprise, and the partnership was told there was no law against it. The state medical authorities were also queried. They replied that there was no law against such a practice. Nothing could be legally done to stop it. After the readings began, Edgar made a habit of reading the transcript of each one. The stuff amazed him. It was so technical, he could not understand it. After each session, he returned to his studio in a state of complete confusion. One of the first visitors to the new office was a man from Nortonville, Kentucky, Frank Moore. Edgar gave a reading for his niece, who had infantile paralysis, or what we now call polio. When the niece showed some improvement, Moore was so determined to put the readings on a scientific basis that he made plans to build a hospital in Nortonville. Patients were having trouble getting Edgar's prescribed treatments carried out. Most medical doctors refused to cooperate, and even orthopedic doctors helped only if Edgar's diagnosis agreed with theirs. But before the plans for a hospital got very far, Moore, a mine owner, was injured in a mining accident. Subsequently, he had some financial reversals and the building plans were halted. Edgar was beginning to realize that Moore was right. To get the treatments carried out properly required the cooperation of several schools of medicine, as well as people who knew about electrical treatments, massage, psychiatry, scientific diet. How could all these experts be brought together except in some kind of treatment facility? Late in February, a man from the Chicago Examiner came to Hopkinsville to do a series of stories about Edgar. As a result of these articles, Edgar was invited to visit Chicago to give several readings. A few days after Edgar returned home, Gertrude gave birth to a second son, Milton. Edgar was happy about the addition to his family, but the baby became ill. He developed whooping cough. This was succeeded by colitis. Before Edgar realized anything was seriously wrong, the doctor suddenly announced that his condition was serious. A reading was taken. But it was too late. Acid had permeated the system. The baby died. Edgar was stunned. He had relied on the medical profession instead of his own power. Despite the faith others had in him, neither he nor Gertrude had the same kind of faith when they needed it. After the baby died, Gertrude's health declined. Dr. Jackson said she had pleurisy, and her condition failed to improve over a period of several months. After another examination, Dr. Jackson called Edgar to his office to tell him that Gertrude's condition had now been diagnosed as tuberculosis, and that condition was serious. Neither Dr. Jackson nor the other doctors he had consulted had any idea how to treat it. Dr. Jackson put his hand on Edgar's shoulder. "You've been helping other people. If there's anything to that monkey business, now's the time to try it. You'd better get a reading on Gertrude." The reading was held in Dr. Jackson's office. Gertrude's sister Carrie, the squire, the Methodist preacher, Dr. Jackson, and two specialists in tuberculosis were present. When Edgar woke, the doctors were shaking their heads. One of the specialists started talking as soon as he saw that Edgar was awake. "Your anatomy is fine, but your treatment is rotten. The things you suggest are what we make medicines out of. We don't use them as they are. Heroin, you say, mixed to make a liquid, given in a capsule, and manufactured three at a time, because after 3 days the compound will disintegrate. That's crazy! You also said to put apple brandy in a charred keg and let her inhale the fumes." Dr. Jackson spoke up. "Well, it can't do her any harm." The other doctors disagreed. After arguing and discussing the case for some time, they left. Edgar asked Ketchum if he could make up the heroin compound, and Ketchum agreed. The doctors had refused to do it. The compound was administered to Gertrude, who was so weak she could barely raise her head from the pillow. After the first capsule, she ceased to have hemorrhages. After the second day, her fever disappeared. The fumes of the apple brandy helped the congestion in her lungs. Very slowly, she gained strength, falling again and again into relapse. They took frequent check readings on her. Edgar watched them anxiously for indications that the tuberculosis was checked. By September, the readings reported some improvement. On November 21st, there were more improvements in some parts of the body, but Gertrude had developed a cold that aggravated the congestion in her head and chest. Her condition was serious, and Edgar was up with her all night. The next morning she was very weak, but the crisis seemed to have passed. The readings were followed carefully, but it was slow, uphill work. By the 1st of January, she had improved considerably. A check reading stated that the inflammation in the lungs had disappeared. That night, Edgar sat by her bedside, reading to her. She put out her hand and took hold of his. "The reading saved my life, Edgar. Thank you." Edgar felt tears come to his eyes. His power was finally proved to himself and to Gertrude, beyond any doubt. That winter, the squire broke his kneecap when he slipped on an icy street. Ketchum took his place at the readings, frequently dispensed with a stenographer at the time of the reading, took notes, and then dictated his own version of what had been said. After several weeks of this, Edgar began to experience headaches after the readings. On a hunch, he wrote a follow-up letter to one of his patients. She wrote back that she had never received a reading, though she had requested one. Edgar confronted Ketchum with the letter. Ketchum tried to explain. "Well, we need money. We can get by, but we need more money if we want to build a hospital. And we have to have a hospital so that the treatments could be carried out properly. But you won't let us charge enough for the readings. We'll never get any place this way. We'll never be able to prove anything, so I haven't been taking some of the readings you thought I was. I've been taking other ones, gambling a little, just getting a few tips, you know. Edgar put the letter down on the desk, picked up his hat and coat, and left. At home, he found Gertrude sitting up, feeling better. He sat down by her. "I've quit Ketchum. I'm going to Alabama to get a job." In 1912, Edgar Casey moved to Selma, Alabama, as an agent of the Tressler Photography Company. He opened a branch studio and after about a year bought it for himself. In the spring of 1913, Dr. Jackson declared Gertrude well, and she came south to join Edgar. The story of the readings did not follow them. Gertrude conducted the check readings that were regularly sent to friends and the relatives in Hopkinsville. One day in 1914, Edgar found Hugh Lynn screaming on the floor of his studio. His face had been burned from an explosion of flash powder. Edgar grabbed him and raced to the office of Dr. Eugene Calloway, an eye specialist. Calloway called for two other doctors to join them. Calloway tried to examine the boy, though it was difficult to hold him still. Finally, he got a dressing and some bandages on Hugh Lynn's eyes. A conference was held in the reception room. None of the doctors had any hope for the child's sight.